You know, the way I see this, I believe in markets. I think markets bring us a lot of innovation, a lot of creation, a lot of change that's good. I want to see, for example, markets for clean, not just clean energy, but how we're going to clean the carbon out of the air, how we're going to clean the filth out of the water. But understand this, markets without rules are theft. They're theft.
That was Senator Elizabeth Warren, a leading Democratic presidential candidate, of course, on a Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman, answering a question, by the way, that basically asked her to defend not being an out and proud socialist, or at least Democratic socialist like Bernie Sanders. Hello, everyone. Happy Veterans / Armistice Day. I am Matt Welch, and welcome to the Reasoned Roundtable. Before we get started, another quick reminder. If you originally subscribed to this very program via something called the Reason Podcast, and as part of that, enjoyed listening to, as we all do, Nick Gillespie conduct in-depth interviews with various scintillating guests, or you like being a flying on the wall at the great Soho Forum debates, you need to take proactive action. You need to take pro-action.
Not a thing.
It's totally a thing. To keep those podcasts in your ear holes, you can fix that right now. We will wait. Catherine will wait. She'll wait her turn to talk. Head over to reason.com/podcasts and click on the subscription buttons for the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie, which comes out every Wednesday, and the Soho Forum debates, which has more of a monthly type of vibe. You won't be sorry you did. Okay. Back to Democrats and Democratic socialists and billionaires and billionaires and the candidate who is attempting to kind of thread all of those needles at once. That makes a lot of sense. Catherine, you're the editor of Reason. Are markets without rules theft? Trick question.
Sort of. Let's talk about it for a minute. As it happens in this very issue, the current issue of Reason magazine, we have several explorations of what it means for things to be regulated, and especially whether that word has been straight up stolen by the government, when in fact there are all kinds of good regulation that are self-regulation. So I would say, yeah, markets without rules are theft, but government is not the only source of rules. And that is a thing that Elizabeth Warren misses over and over and over in literally everything she does. She basically says there should be order, there should be rules, and then skips straight to, I'm going to make them up and enforce them at the point of a gun. And that's not the only way.
Catherine, before,
is she going to put people in cages?
Yeah, dude, she is.
Okay.
I know you're saying that like, haha, I'm cool and not a crazy, you know,
no,
zealous
I'm just
libertarian.
Asking.
But yes, she straight up is, and that's wrong. And she is. She was right, of course, about markets being a source of change and innovation and many, many good things. And she was wrong in her implication that the only way to get the good stuff out of markets is to have the government regulate out the bad stuff.
Before I ask a follow-up question, Catherine, about the clean.
I like the clean.
I want to apologize for not introducing at the top also Nick Gillespie and Peter Suderman. Both of you, I will be engaging in ritual self-criticism privately at the end of this podcast. Sorry for all.
why do you say silently?
That's a good question.
That's what I'm going to add to my, what am I consuming? I'm consuming public condemnations of Matt Welch.
It's supposed to be what
every day.
It's supposed to be what
all day.
I'm also producing
things
them.
You're consuming, not like what you always consume every day. But
standing commitments.
Happy Monday, y'all.
All right, Peter, I'm just going to go to you because I already forgot what I was going to ask Catherine here. So this has led to yet another round of, you know, should billionaires exist type of commentary and also discussions of Elizabeth Warren's billionaire tax, which is kind of the thing that sparked a lot of this conversation. Peter, the New York Times over this weekend had an article that I've already seen retweeted with the little fact nugget. Over and over again, widely cited, it's about Warren's billionaire tax. And I'm going to quote to you basically the nut graph of this, okay? According to estimates by two economists who advised Ms. Warren, If her wealth tax had been in effect since 1982, for example, Bill Gates would have had $13.9 billion in 2018 instead of $97 billion. Jeff Bezos would have had $48.8 billion last year instead of $160 billion. And Michael Bloomberg, who is considering running for president himself, that's foreshadowing for later in this program, would have had $12.3 billion instead of $51.8 billion. Peter Suderman, what's wrong with that nut graph that I just read to you?
An awful lot. Let's start with the assumption that it would actually raise that much money. The problem with these retroactive hypothetical applications of the wealth tax is similar to the problem with the assumptions that Elizabeth Warren's campaign is making about the wealth tax. She thinks that it could raise about $2.75 trillion, and that's just the initial wealth tax, not the one that she added on, that she expanded for her Medicare for All financing package. She thinks that the initial wealth tax could raise about $2.75 trillion, and there's a bunch of good reasons to think that it would raise far, far less than that. First, they don't really, these estimates don't really account for the likely negative economic feedback effects. You put a wealth tax in place like this, and it just changes the incentive structure. There's a quote from Alan Viard, an economist at the American Enterprise Institute, in that New York Times article that says that the tax rate on capital income at the top could easily exceed 100% once the wealth tax is in there. And so this just totally changes the economic incentives for people who have, like Bill Gates and like Jeff Bezos, who have been incredibly productive, added to the economy. It's hard to imagine that they would have done exactly the same thing if the wealth tax had been in place. Second, there is some significant dispute about actually how much wealth exists at the very top. There was a paper that was actually it's been somewhat overlooked in this debate, but there was a paper presented to the National Bureau of Economic Research over the summer that estimated that the actual amount of top wealth that exists, that is to say, the amount that a wealth tax like this could actually touch, is something like half of what Sasse and Zuckman, the economists that Warren and her campaign rely on, actually estimate here. And so if that's the case, then there is an awful lot less wealth and they would get a lot less money out of that. And third, as Larry Summers, the former Obama administration economist who has been criticizing these estimates all year, keeps arguing, it just doesn't factor in nearly enough avoidance or financial restructuring on behalf of the very wealthy. And that's what we've seen in other countries. The majority of Western democracies that have tried wealth taxes have repealed them because they don't raise nearly as much money as estimated. And what they do instead is encourage capital flight. And so that takes us back to the first point, which is negative economic feedback effects here. And so the assumption that you can just put this in place and very wealthy people will continue to do exactly what they have already done, have always done, and that it will raise money along those lines, it's a bad assumption. But then there's another sort of big problem with this that's somewhat independent of the actual estimates and sort of the economics. And that is, all of this is predicated on the idea that Elizabeth Warren or someone like her could spend this money better than these billionaires could spend it. And in the case of somebody like Bill Gates or Warren Buffett, those folks have pledged to give at least half of their money, of their fortunes, to charity. And so if you have billionaires saying we're going to set up charities, we're going to spend our money on nonprofits that aren't designed to raise money, that are just designed to give this money away in ways that we believe are going to be effective at changing the world and making it a better place, I would much rather have almost forget the kind of moral implications. I would much rather have a kind of distributed system there in which Buffett tries his nonprofits and Gates tries his nonprofits and Bezos tries his. And it's not just all, it's not all centralized in the federal government paying for the 6 education and healthcare programs that Elizabeth Warren has at the top of her campaign ticket. It's a very bad idea, both sort of as economics and as an economic system, as a sort of moral and philosophical system that says, well, look, bureaucrats in Washington, Elizabeth Warren and her successors are the people who need to spend this money. And we're just going to go ahead and take it and assume that that won't change anything for people who create wealth.
Nick, you were saying.
Yeah, to kind of continue or extend that point, there's also this completely false idea that the federal government is somehow constrained in how it spends by the amount of money it brings in. We are looking at a $1 trillion deficit right now. The federal government doesn't give a shit how much money it has before it can spend on stupid new programs or ineffective old programs. It continues to spend. It continues to create new entitlements and new spending programs. I think, you know, one for me, the main critique of Warren's proposal, you know, it's all true that, like, it's not going to raise the amount of money, et cetera, but there are ways to lay taxes where you would get more revenue out of people and it might not distort the economy in a terrible way. But there's this idea that if we simply lop off, if Jeff Bezos et al. Were making a third of what they made, that money would somehow be in the treasury and it would be being used to alleviate whatever is the problem. You know, it would create the market for clean, it would help poor people, et cetera. And, you know, we know that the government is already spending vast sums of money on all sorts of kind of remediative programs to help people who are in poverty, to, you know, make college affordable and things like that. And they already don't work the way that they're intended. So, you know, this idea that if only Bezos had less money, we would all have more money and better government is just something that really needs to be argued. Having said all of that, I do think that the way that Warren is framing this is really smart and is really kind of attractive to a lot of people, because most people, I think, fall into her camp. You know, Bernie Sanders says, I'm a socialist, and then he explains, I don't really mean a socialist, but he means a government maximalist who hates markets. On the other hand, you have people like Donald Trump pretending to be a capitalist, even though he, you know, he has used government much more effectively than Warren or Sanders to get his way and to make money, you know, through the various ways he's intersected with the government. But most people in America, I think, buy a version of what Warren is saying, which is that capitalism is a very good thing and that it needs guardrails, that it needs, you know, regulations, that it needs some kind of outside a way of keeping it from being really destructive. And I think as libertarians, we need to understand that, we need to engage that, and then we need to rebut that in ways that will speak to people in the middle, because people do look at the 2008 financial crisis and they say, you know, that was the fault of exuberant market forces and deregulation, rather than understanding it as the inevitable and sad outcome of too much government intervention into various types of markets.
As to Nick's point about government spending however much it wants anyway, you know, Warren has this very bad plan out that we talked about last week to finance Medicare for all. Let's say that you believe that it worked exactly as she said it was going to, and that it raised enough money to pay for Medicare for all over the next 10 years. There are two big issues that still remain. One is that doesn't cover Medicare's current shortfall, which I will remind you all again, that's coming in 2026. It's going to be insolvent in not very long. And the other problem is that if the wealth tax portion of it works as designed, and the economists who wrote up this plan and did these estimates have said that it is designed to degrade the fortunes of very wealthy people. So that means it's not just that it's going to tax, you know, a little bit of what they've got every year on sort of a rolling basis. They're taxing a stock rather than a flow, right? So it's a sort of set, imagine sort of a mountain of money that is getting smaller and smaller and smaller, right? Rather than a river of money where you're dipping your money tax collection. Anyway, it's a, right. Catherine's face is making it impossible to could, right? And so what happens at the end of this is that mountain is much smaller, and therefore there is much less to tax in the second decade, and even less to tax in the third decade, and even less to tax in the fourth decade. And so eventually, even if it works like they want it to work, and you eliminate all of these mountains of money, that's where you were getting your revenue from, and you no longer can use those money mountains to pay for Medicare for all, education reforms, and the rest of the Warren agenda.
I just want to point out that metaphor made a lot of sense to me, and it created a 3D visual in my own brain, and thank you for it.
So,
Peter.
I absolutely would have allowed that metaphor to stand because it was internally consistent. I am not anti-metaphor. I am anti-mixed metaphor, and it's a crucial difference. However, I would like to go ahead and hijack this metaphor for my own dark purposes, because I really think the other defense of billionaires is rockets. And I know it's me and I've said this before, but I really want to say it again, partially because I was reinvigorated in this case. I got the chance to interview Bert Rutan, the designer and pilot of Spaceship One, this weekend. But one thing that Rutan said was that the entire private spaceflight industry is due basically to four billionaires. And they are Paul Allen, who funded Spaceship One, Richard Branson, Elon Musk, and Jeff Bezos. And what he said, and this is just a very, very simple point, and it gets exactly to what Peter was saying, which is you could maybe use your billions to cure cancer, and some billionaires will, or maybe the government will take your billions and try to use it to cure cancer, although
there are certainly
Joe Biden is doing a bad job of that.
There's
right
certainly
now.
A lot of billionaires, though, who are giving an awful lot of money to attempting to cure cancer right now.
But so some billionaires will do that. But even if you cured cancer, you're still saving, I think, 14% of humanity. Whereas if you manage to get to space, you might be saving all of it. And I really think that's an important point. You need diversity and you need weirdness in your charity and in your sort of backup plans for humans. So what I'm saying is you need the money mountain to build your launch pad on so that you're already closer to space.
Wow. Okay. I see. There's
an alternative argument worth kind of sketching out here too, which is, part of the attack on billionaire and the eliminationist rhetoric against, all billionaires are a policy failure and things like that. Robert Reich, the former labor secretary under Bill Clinton, talked about, there are five ways that you can become a billionaire, and all of them involve theft or force or crime. Basically, that's false. When you look at the people that we're talking about, for the most part, Michael Bloomberg came up with a news service that is immensely useful to the people in the financial services industry and information services. Jeff Bezos is not creating money by, showing up at your house and robbing you. He's bringing you more and more shit faster and faster at cheaper and cheaper prices. The people who make massive amounts of money, like the billionaire class, and it doesn't mean that they shouldn't be criticized and that they shouldn't be mocked and that perhaps they should be taxed in more efficient ways. But by and large, the way people get rich is by giving lots of people stuff they want at prices that are, too good to ignore. One of the things that bothers me about Elizabeth Warren's rhetoric, and I think there's a lot of this in the Democratic Party right now in particular, and it's creeping into the Republican Party, is the idea that capitalism is a system of exploitation as opposed to a system that, as Joseph Schumpeter would say, it's constantly mutating to serve changing demands, that is constantly in flux. It's based on creative destruction. It's based on innovation. And it's based on bringing silk stocking, not making more silk stockings for queens, but rather bringing them in the reach of factory people who are always left out of any other kind of wealth production system.
What I'm struck by reading Robert Reich's tweets in front of me, right? So it's profiting from a monopoly, insider trading, political payoffs, fraud, or inheritance. Those are the only ways that one can accumulate $1 billion in America. And none of these has anything to do with being successful in the supposed free market. I mean, go to Amazon, to speak of one, and just do a search on like $1 billion fill in the blank, right? Like George Soros made $1 billion betting against the British pound. And a lot of people are mad at him for that. And he's, retroactively apologetic for that, for the way that plays into stereotypes about Jewish financiers, which is an insane way of looking at it. But whatever, it was a trade on the markets. There wasn't insider trading. There wasn't political payoffs. There wasn't fraud. There wasn't inheritance. There are these things called capital markets. Sometimes people make big bets on the capital markets, and sometimes they win those bets. None of that is profiting from a monopoly at all. It's a kind of a staggering demonstration of ignorance to say such a thing when you actually were a cabinet-level official in an administration. Catherine, I want you to respond to another anti-billionaire rant from Michael Tomasky, who otherwise has really great taste in 2008 or 2007 biographies of John McCain. But he says in a New York Times op-ed about billionaires, he says, quote, "These fortunes will destroy our democracy. Because any democracy needs a robust and thriving middle class, and we have spent the last 30 or so years transferring trillions of dollars from the middle class to the people at the very top. This is carnage, plain and simple. No democratic society can let that keep happening and expect to stay a democracy. Is he right or is he totally right, Catherine?
I mean, he is right.
My God,
that we have. I know. I'm subverting all your expectations today, Matt. I'm here to shake things up. No, he is right, of course, in the sense that we do sometimes transfer money from the middle class to billionaires. We do that, but it's in the form of course, corporate welfare and crony capitalist giveaways and other things that we here at Reason have inveighed against for decades.
Medicare.
And also in the form of Medicare.
Seriously.
Which if anyone who knows a rich old person knows that basically their hobby is going to the doctor on the dime of current middle class workers. Like, that's what old people do. I'm having a little bit of generational rage. Can you tell? And
many of them also have Medigap policies.
Yes. So anyway,
which also rip off the poor and young.
So that bit is true. But of course, more broadly, the idea that billionaires threaten democracy is utterly absurd. You know, getting back to the Robert Reich tweet. Also, I'm assuming that what he's doing there is like a weird kind of definitional thing. Like, if he considers any large successful business a monopoly, then okay, some of the people who got a lot of money got it by profiting off of a monopoly. That, of course, is a fundamental misunderstanding of monopolies. You know, I think the idea, the phrasing should not exist is such an incredible construction, too. Like, first of all, just the kind of... That phrasing should not exist. That's correct. Because it sort of implies that, like, they'll wither, I guess, away once justice is served, or that they'll see the error of their ways and, you know, self-deport from the billionaire class or whatever it is, when in fact, as in all class war-based politics, in the end, there will either be confiscation or violence. That is, they'll either be put into a cage, Nick.
Yeah, or billionaires in cages.
Their money will be taken at the point of a gun. And that is an element of all of these plans that genuinely shouldn't be underestimated. Like, that is a real... If you think a category of people shouldn't exist, you're going to have to eradicate that category, and the people in that category are not going to enjoy it, and that is where states are at their worst.
You know, one way you can make $1 billion that wasn't covered there is you can write the Harry Potter books. And J.K. Rowling was listed for about 7 years on the Forbes billionaire list. She no longer is. And the reason she no longer is because she gave away so much money to charity. That's great.
But
now, this is outside the American tax system. I do want to be clear. Britain's taxes on very wealthy people are a little higher, and that's an additional reason why she dropped out of the list. But still, she didn't exploit anyone. She made $1 billion by making
kids... She exploited
kids,
our sense of magic.
I mean,
by making
elves.
Kids happy.
Dobby.
But I assume that Robert Reich would say... that's somehow she fits in category one, right? Like, I assume he would not be like, oh, my God, you're right, J.K. Rowling, my whole theory is wrong. He would say, like, when you create something that powerful and that valuable, it belongs to the people or something stupid, right?
I mean, you know, after many, many, many decades,
I don't think
yes,
it's worth.
It should be completely fine for people to write and even profit off of Harry Potter fanfic. But, like... J.K. Rowling deserves
pretty
the
sure that
money
project
that she
is
made,
already well
right?
underway.
Yes, no, I'm certain. I understand that. But like J.K. Rowling, didn't start an exploitative business. Didn't like which she didn't do any of these things that billionaires are accused of doing. What she did was she wrote some great books that captured the hearts and imaginations of an entire generation more successfully probably than anyone since George Lucas, who who sold the rights to Star Wars and Lucasfilm for, I believe, $4 billion to Disney. And like that sort of creativity, Like, I just don't see the case for not rewarding it. I don't see, and J.K. Rowling might even be against me on this, but she, like, because she is, you know, sort of talked about how she thinks it's great that Britain taxes people, you know, and has higher social welfare spending than in the United States. So I'm, to be clear, not taking J.K. Rowling's personal position in this, but I think her wealth was earned. And I think the people who are talking about how billionaires are inherently bad sort of fail to account for the fact that most, certainly the many, many of the people who make billions in their lives are engaged in essentially creative endeavors, whether that is creating a website where you can buy Harry Potter books or whether that is writing the Harry Potter books in the first place.
Nick, did I hear you rising to a defense of Michael Tomasky there?
I actually think the biggest problem here is it's complete misdirection. And in Tomasky, who I'm friendly with, he was my editor when I wrote a column at the Daily Beast. I like him a lot. He wrote a great book about the Beatles that I highly recommend people check out. But he talks at one point, he comes from West Virginia, and he says, you know, imagine if there weren't billionaires or if they were taxed heavily, if Warren's tax had been in place, like what all of that extra revenue could have done to help people in West Virginia. And, you know, wealth inequality has grown over the past 30, 40, 50 years. Yeah, that's all great, except for the fact that in West Virginia, poor people in West Virginia are vastly better off now than they were in the 1960s when Robert F. Kennedy and every other politician was going and doing poverty tours in Appalachia. What capitalist society does is that fundamentally what it does is it increases the standards of living for everybody in it, especially poor and lower income people. They are the ones who are now living a facsimile of Bill Gates's existence because they have cars, they have indoor plumbing, they have access to education, they have TVs that are basically the same ones that Bill Gates is watching. It shrinks the distance between, you know, the plutocracy and the lumpen proletariat in a way that no other system does. And getting rid of Bill Gates or cutting his wealth down is not going to change what it's like to be in West Virginia. But capitalism has risen, it has increased the living standards there. And that's an important thing. And the idea that this is the whole system is bad, I think is something we need to push back on. And that markets, even when I think about this a lot with healthcare, with education, with retirement, in relation to food. People will say, they'll look at healthcare and they'll say people get priced out of insurance or going to the doctor. That's a bad thing. But overall, a free market in medicine or a relatively free market in medicine functions pretty well. And the best way to address the problems is to subsidize people who can't participate fully in it or as in an empowered way as possible. We don't look at, you know, the fringe cases of people not having enough to eat in America and say the government has to regulate all of the prices and all of the business deals and all of the interactions in that market. What we do is we let it ride and then we give people supplemental income. Ideally, we would just give them unrestricted cash grants instead of food stamps or anything like that that restrict what they can buy and what they can spend on. But the way you take a market that is mostly or almost perfectly functioning and then you help people to participate in it who are on the edges that can't. You don't destroy the market in order to help, you know, a few hard luck cases.
I commend anyone who is susceptible to Nick's 1960s versus now West Virginia comparison to go check out the weekend Twitter feed of Captain Kirk. William Shatner.
That's right.
Was dropping truth
James
bombs.
Tiberius Kirk.
Truth bombs. Yep. He's adjusting for inflation over time. He was talking about wealth taxes.
Set truth bombs to kill. Matt
wow.
Welch.
Okay.
Those are
Boomer.
Like photon torpedoes.
So yeah, go look at that. Speaking of billionaires, let's transition into the aforementioned foreshadowing of Michael Bloomberg. Last week, the former diminutive mayor of New York City let slip yet again.
He's still short. He's still short, Matt. He's just
been
not
growing in
York
stature, Nick, ever since. He's thinking about running for president yet again. This is like the fourth time. He was doing it in 2007, 2016. He was doing it for a while last year and then stopped doing it. Now he's doing it again. He's registered for the Alabama. He's got some kind of Super Tuesday strategy in case Joe Biden's internal robot malfunctions, or I'm not exactly sure what's going on. A piece in Politico, I think this morning, noted that the first poll including Bloomberg, has him at a robust 4% in the Democratic field. And a quote from that piece is, "No contender is viewed more negatively by Democrats than the billionaire former New York City mayor." Catherine, our friends at the Manhattan Institute seem to like Michael Bloomberg just fine. So what's so bad about him?
I will never forgive Michael Bloomberg for soda taxes, and no one else should either. I know that it's petty. And I used to be the kind of person that said, oh, we focus too much on this nanny state stuff. And meanwhile, you know, our entitlements are exploding. But I have absolutely flipped on that. And I now think nanny state stuff reveals all. And Bloomberg is the ultimate nanny. He is the perfect, horrible combination of Bill de Blasio and Kamala Harris, which is not what this field needs. And he wants to kind of stand by a kind of law and order politics that he practiced as mayor, which is now rightly out of fashion in the Democratic Party. And he is a meddling douchebag who will not leave people alone. He needs to sit down and shut up.
Peter, I don't understand.
Wow.
You live in Washington, Peter. I don't understand the theory of the case here. Like the lane. If we believe in lanes towards a primary, isn't there a guy named
what lane is this?
Isn't there a guy named Joe Biden? Correct me if I'm wrong here. Correct me, Peter. Hasn't Joe Biden been getting 30% of the vote in preliminary polling the entire race, except for that month that they announced when it was up at 35%? Like, what's the theory of the case here?
Michael Bloomberg is the self-checkout lane. Like, you think it's going to be a little bit faster, and it doesn't really work all that well. And the person in front of you has like three items, but it somehow takes like 40 minutes. And then you realize you're buying beer. And so you've got to get the manager, to like check you out. And it's by the end, you're just like, why didn't I get in a different lane? I think the theory of the case question is a good one, and it's one that actually a lot of liberals have raised. It's what is Michael Bloomberg doing in this race? Who does he think he can appeal to? And in some ways, I wonder if that is the wrong way to think about this. Obviously, I think Michael Bloomberg would like to be president, and he would like to win. At the same time, my suspicion is here that he has looked at this field and looked at this race and seen Elizabeth Warren rising up in the polls, seen Joe Biden kind of struggling just a little bit. Joe Biden's poll numbers are actually about as stable, a relatively stable, and he's not doing nearly as badly as people think. But he does consistently appear to be a weak quasi, maybe not even front runner at this point, and Buttigieg is sort of nipping at his heels. And so Michael Bloomberg, who has always viewed himself as a sort of practical, pragmatic, democratic centrist, thinks that that perspective is not being well carried in the Democratic race. And so he thinks somebody needs to be there to make that case. I'm not sure that this is the best way to do it. I think one of the better criticisms here is just, if that's what you want in this race, why not spend your money, your $100 million or whatever it is you're going to spend out of your 50-something billion-dollar fortune, why not spend that money on a super PAC for a moderate candidate who has a better chance, say somebody like Cory Booker, or even like Pete Buttigieg, who is a favorite of sort of that class of people.
Why would you expect? Bloomberg was a phenomenally multi-term mayor of New York City. Why would he be like, oh yeah, Mayor Pete, he'll get my vote, even though Mayor Pete is calling for national service and packing
Bloomberg,
the Supreme Court and stuff like that. Bloomberg is a data guy, and what he built
was a platform for financial data. It's incredibly valuable. They also publish an awful lot of a fair amount of like really good journalism, including, I should be clear, full disclosure here, my wife was employed by Bloomberg Opinion for several years. I think that one way that Bloomberg could have gone about this would be to look at the actual polls and look at surveys about his candidacy and say, the way I can be most effective is to help back another candidate.
But that's you're like taking ego, and you're also taking the possibility of him doing well or injecting a totally different set of discourses into the Democratic nomination process, as well as political discourse, which we were just talking about how billionaires aren't evil, they're not terrible people. Bloomberg was, you know, he had his problems as mayor of New York. He hates pot legalization. He's insane on the issue. Even worse, you know, as bad as it would be to put people in cages for, you know, buying big gulps and super big gulps, we're actually putting people and still putting people in jail. And New York under him was putting people in jail for fucking carrying weed with them. It, you know, that's insane. By the same token, he is, unlike Elizabeth Warren, an actual capitalist. And he's looking at the Democratic, passel of candidates. He's looking at how none of them is actually interested in pursuing anything like capitalism or doing well. And I think his intervention into this race would be a good thing, not because I want him to be president, but I think he would actually be somebody who could speak to why capitalism is generally a good system and a better system than the alternatives to it that people like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders are putting forth. I don't give a shit who wins the Democratic nomination. I don't really care who's president. I want to live in a country where we're talking about capitalism in a smarter, better way. And I have to say, you know, I think Bloomberg would actually help push that forward in a world where, you know, all of the leading candidate or most of the leading candidates in the Democratic Party are saying billionaires are
policy
failures.
Well, he's an interesting counterweight to both Elizabeth Warrenism and Trumpism. And, you know, in this, insofar as libertarians are going to be interested in someone like him, it's in the way that he kind of rejects the fundamental premises of both, of Elizabeth Warren's wealth taxing sort of giant, you know, social democracy kind of, you know, highly, you know, extremely regulated economically kind of approach to things. And in Donald Trump's extremely closed off to the world, sort of like, well, I hate, you know, I hate sort of the elite. I hate working with people. I hate doing things in like a normal and sensible way. And like the, you know, sort of he is positioning himself as a sort of a third point on the triangle between the two of them as like I said, a counterweight to both ideologies and both sensibilities. It's less clear to me that there is a real big constituency for that right now in American politics, even though I would certainly like there to be a counterweight, an effective counterweight to both the Warren worldview and the Trump worldview.
I would say just that the stuff that Bloomberg is either not terrible at or good at is the stuff that Democrats hate him for, and the stuff that he's that Democrats like him for are either terrible things or things that will not get him anywhere in a general election either. For instance, is a kind of a hysterical anti-gun, also anti-vaping and other things like that. That's where Bloomberg is to me.
You know, the backstory of a lot of Bloomberg, even, you know, thinking about getting into the race and stuff, is the fact that the Democratic Party, like the Republican Party in a kind of more dramatic way, the Democratic Party does not have a core set of issues anymore. It is going through a massive transition right now to a point where there are virtually no centrist Democrats. There were, until Trump was elected, the free trade Democrat had disappeared. You know, they had gone extinct. They've come back a little bit. It's clearly situational because even people like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders and most of the other candidates struggle to explain why they disagree with Trump's tariffs against China, other than that they would leave them in permanently because they actually don't believe in free trade. You know, this is it. It's an interesting question to ask. The soul of the Republican Party is, you know, who knows where it is, because what they used to believe in up until about 15 minutes ago has gone completely out the window in obeisance to Trump's, you know, blood sugar spikes. But the Democratic Party is also going through the same kind of loss of identity. And, you know, I think somebody like Bloomberg, who was a Republican as a mayor of New York, then an independent, and is now flirting with, with the Democratic Party, is a kind of centrist. He's much more regulatory and much more kind of nanny state-ish than I think anybody who calls themselves a libertarian is comfortable with. But he's also a mainstream kind of presence in a party that is floundering. And most of the Democrats, when you look at the battleground states, the New York Times had a story about this recently, they want somebody who is less progressive than what you're getting at the top of the Democratic
ticket
right
now. Let's, Nick, reference to blood sugar spikes. So let's get to this because we didn't last week. There's a president who's a Republican who's in the news a lot. And since the last time that we have convened, even there's been a ton of impeachment related news there. You had Rand Paul at a Trump rally in Kentucky last week, beseeching the fake news media to out the whistleblower who kickstarted this whole process. Molly Hemingway over the weekend at Fox News actually said the name of someone who's been associated with being that whistleblower. I don't know if it's true or not.
Are we not saying the name?
I have no reason to say the name. And if you...
Why wouldn't you, though?
I'm not interested in it. I don't know if that's the person or not.
Okay.
I mean, it's up to you. Your boss is on the line, too. We also had on Tuesday, Kentucky Governor Matt Bevin, a Republican, narrowly lost a reelection bid in a development that was interpreted at least somewhat as being unfavorable towards the sense of the transferal appeal of Donald Trump among Republicans. We started to get over the weekend some reporting coming from the Anonymous book there. And Nikki Haley has a new book out that apparently said that claiming that John Kelly and Rex Tillerson came to her at some point to, quote, save the country, unquote, from Trump. And then meanwhile, most relevantly to any discussion about impeachment going forward, we're shifting to phase two this week on Wednesday. It's scheduled. We're going to have a publicly televised hearings about impeachment. First time we've seen that delightful spectacle since 1998. So let's just go to a lightning round of anything from that grab bag of impeachment related news or Trump related news that we all find of particular interest to our own idiosyncratic tastes. Catherine, I shall start with you.
I followed with interest the tidbit from the Anonymous book suggesting that Mike Pence had potentially explored the use of the 25th Amendment, which strikes me to remove Trump from office, which strikes me as a sort of an interesting detail and also one that may play out as sort of a subcurrent in a lot of these impeachment conversations has been, okay, so let's say the president is actually impeached and removed, which is a big if, then we have a President Pence, which is not exactly the dream scenario of those who have been most aggressively in favor of impeachment. And I think this ties in a little bit with our earlier conversation about, like, well, how much do we even like the status quo anymore? Like, how, like, I know I have found myself occasionally much more pro status quo pre-Trump than I was when we had it. I think that's true of many, many people who would like to see change of some kind in this country. So I am interested in Pence's aggressive, explicit denial of the fact that he chatted with some folks about maybe removing the president, because what if that's where we end up and what does the country look like? And I think our nostalgia for status quo could evaporate pretty quickly once we were back to it.
Nick, what jumped out to you?
You know, this discussion about whether or not the whistleblower should not be named, even though he's been named in various press accounts, and also, we have an anonymous tell-all. I love anonymous political speech. You know, it helped create the groundswell for, you know, the ratification of the U.S. Constitution. It's a good thing. I don't believe that there should be mandatory, disclosure of campaign funding or anything like that. By the same token, knowing who the person is who's leaking stuff is a helpful bit of information in trying to weigh whether or not the evidence is accurate. And less so in the case of the whistleblower, because you have some documents that are kind of independent of what the whistleblower may or may not think about them. When you're talking about an anonymous book, written by anonymous with a lot of anonymous conversations, most of that, I guarantee you, will be revealed as utter and complete horseshit. And, you know, it matters, like, you read primary colors differently when it's by anonymous and then when you know it was written by Joe Klein. You know, this is just the basic fact of literary interpretation. So I'm disappointed, broadly speaking, in the way that Rand Paul has conducted himself in the Trump since Trump has become president. But I don't see a problem with talking about who the whistleblower is or naming them and speculating about who it is in the press.
Suderman?
It has continued to strike me as notable how much Republicans have focused both on the process and then relatedly on the whistleblower who started this process in motion. And the whistleblower's initial complaint is now in some ways secondary, if not just irrelevant to where we're at, which we have sworn testimony that has been given to the House, including notably this last week, we had Ambassador Sondland, who had initially testified, you know, well, that there was no quid pro quo, that there was no conditions attached to the aid, right? That that this whole, you know, he had negotiated this, sort of been running this thing and negotiating this thing, and had never said that there were any conditions attached to the aid. And then this week, after reading some additional testimonies, he updated his testimony, saying that he had, quote, refreshed my recollection.
Yep.
Which is such a delightful phrase.
Such a DC phrase.
And in his refreshed recollection, what he said was, basically, well, we told them that we wouldn't give them the aid unless they made a statement to the effect that they were investigating Joe Biden's son. And so, again, the focus on the whistleblower's identity, the process here, the actual content of what we have learned, the actual substance of this investigation has revealed, in some ways, what was pretty clear from the beginning, which is that Trump did exactly what he has been accused of doing, which is held up financial aid to Ukraine in order to get Ukraine to start an investigation into the Bidens, or at least to announce an investigation, the announcement actually being more important, apparently, than the investigation itself, because Trump wanted a cloud of sort of the appearance of corruption to be hanging over a potential Democratic presidential rival. He used foreign aid funding for personal political gain. That's what he's been accused of. That, by all the evidence, is what he did. And what Republicans are talking about is not the actual substance. They're talking about, well, the process here. Did we get the sort of to ask witnesses the questions we wanted? What is the name of this whistleblower, and why? What were his reasons for coming forward? They just don't really have a substantive answer to the charges themselves.
Yeah, but that's also, the process isn't done
yet. True.
I mean, I agree with you, but it's also, you know, this is like, oh, you know, you hear the prosecution's case, particularly one that's kind of litigated through a media that is, you know, obviously wanting Trump's removal, and if not his actual removal, his humiliation publicly. You know, it's worth, you know, obviously charting that and tracking that and analyzing that. And then we need to see what happens when the whole story starts to come.
There also has been a little bit of kind of adding extra steps to the story that I found interesting. So, I mean, maybe this is just because I was not as deep in it as some, but this little bit of a shift from the quid pro quo that supposedly happened in the phone call, which was explicitly investigation for aid, or was implicitly investigation for aid. There is now, in the testimony that was released on Friday and some other stuff that's come out, it looks like there was this other step, which was actually theater for theater. It was announce an investigation in exchange for a meeting with the White House between the two presidents, which in turn would then, in theory, result in the confirmation of that aid package. But I think, you know, the idea that vital military aid was being withheld is more intelligible. It's easier for people to understand. The idea that somebody wanted a formal meeting or a state dinner or whatever it was, and that the aid may or may not have resulted from that, but it was really about the theater on that end too, just makes me hate every politician even more.
It's definitely the case that the story has shifted a little bit from what the initial whistleblower complaint alleged. But in some ways, you know, sort of that's how these things work, in the same way that, say, if a reporter here at Reason got a tip about something that was going on and then you went and investigated it, if what you found was that the tipster didn't have the story exactly right, but had pointed you in the direction of a true story that was worth telling, then it wouldn't matter to a great extent if the tipster was not completely accurate.
But it would have been wrong to just publish the tipster's account,
yes, of course,
which arguably is what the press has verged on doing in this case.
But the press has also published,
but then as good libertarians,
many accounts, both formally released and leaked out of the House impeachment inquiry that has gone on so far, and has given us a reasonably good sort of day by day, blow by blow update about what is going on and who's saying what.
As good libertarians, do we believe, and this is not a legal proceeding or it's not a court proceeding or anything, don't we agree, though, that process matters, and that if police get certain types of evidence through shady means or false means, that invalidates the evidence? You know,
yes, the There is no indication in this case that House Democrats have actually violated any of the process requirements. They are conducting this according to the rules that were in place and according to the rules that they then voted on.
I would just add that my two cents this morning, I think Peter King, the noxious IRA-loving Republican, longtime congressman from Long Island, announced that he was not going to seek re-election. I mentioned this on Twitter. This isn't precisely impeachment related in his particular case, but my magazine column for the forthcoming issue that's already at the printer was about number of GOP House resignations, or not resignations, but announcements that they're not seeking re-election, but we had to keep going back in because there would always be a new one to add to it. I think Peter King is now the 23rd, I could have that wrong, but somewhere along those lines, compared to, I think it's now 8 or 9 Democrats. Those are historically pretty high numbers. I think the total number of House Republicans since the time of Trump's inauguration that have left has already surpassed Obama's bleeding of or self-deportations of Democrats under his first term. It's interesting in that Peter King's not going to be this person. He's going to continue being a very vocal supporter of Donald Trump, but other of the class of Republicans who have announced they won't seek re-election have been some of the ones who are most willing then next, literally the next day, to criticize Trump pretty strenuously, including Congressman Will Hurd, the Texas Republican, over the weekend on the Weekend Chat Show. So that's always something to look at just in terms of, their sense of being kind of like ex-Latin American presidents suddenly are in favor of the drug war or in favor of ending the drug war. You have ex-Republican lawmakers suddenly talking differently about President Trump. All right, let's go to the NO show. What stuff you have been consuming? I'm going to go first. I'm going to cheat in that this isn't a consumption or this isn't frivolous at all, but I just wanted to say it since I have voice, Nick. Nick and I were making jokes about talking like 23-year-olds before this thing started. So, but no, someone who's near and dear to all of us here in this in podcast, in this organization, who might not be a household name to people listening, but should be. And this is related to experiences that three of the four of us enjoyed over this past week, the Atlas Society annual gala, and also Reason presented its Savas Award. The person who underwrote both of those dinners this past week in New York passed away. His name is Don Smith. As a longtime donor to all kinds of libertarian organizations and causes, frequently, as we found out, I found out to a degree that, and I knew Don decently well, but just what a frugal SOB he was. And I say this very fondly. There was in both the tributes to him by David Knott, president of the Reason Foundation, and also by Tom Palmer over at Atlas Society, like being around Don as he's like tisking people for buying cups of coffee at Starbucks because you could, you know, get your own, or you take the Chinese bus up between New York and Washington, D.C. instead of the in order to save money so that he could spend more of it on helping libertarian causes, the world around. Just a terrific, funny, great guy. Died 10 days ago, 12 days ago, rather suddenly. And just wanted to shout out tribute to him and his family, the Smith Family Foundation. As David Knott had mentioned in his remarks, in 2008, after the financial crisis, David and I came up to New York. I was living in D.C. at the time, trying to wrap our heads around what the hell just happened. And by far the most kind of lucid and cogent explanation just for what was in the markets that went haywire came from Don Smith. He was an investor, a very successful one, talking about, as we were mentioning earlier, how you can make money. Honestly, he did so trading on the capital markets. But he will be missed. Great guy. Nick, I heard you clearing your throat. So why don't you go next, and if you have anything to add to that.
Share your condolences to the family of Don Smith. He was a fantastic benefactor, a really generous guy, but also a visionary guy who I learned a lot from over the 20 years that I knew him. I watched, over the weekend, I guess, I watched Living With Yourself, a Netflix show starring Paul Rudd, which is about a character who ends up cloning himself inadvertently, and then it's about living with your clone, having marital problems, work problems, etc. It's a fantastic, it's the first season of a series. It's a fantastic show and a kind of meditation on identity, on marriage, on work, on life. I highly recommend it. And also, partly for a reason, Peter Suderman has an interesting piece in the latest print issue of Reason about what does television mean now at an age of streaming culture. And it's not simply that we can have more stuff on demand. What's being produced and especially how we consume it is changing. And a show like Living With Yourself is one of these shows that the concept of binge watching it is just a really deep and wonderful way to kind of curl up. Instead of curling up over a long weekend with a book, you curl up over a long weekend with a TV show that kind of haunts and permeates your consciousness. And it's a radically different way of engaging, I think, creative expression, and really interesting and fascinating. And you know, this show in particular, because the themes, which it's both comic and serious about technology and about all of the possibilities that are in front of us. It's just a wonderful kind of show and experience. Living With Yourself with Paul Rudd on Netflix.
Suderman?
I have been curling up over the last week or two with a video game called The Outer Worlds. It is a science fiction role-playing game by Obsidian Entertainment, which is the creator of a bunch of the best role-playing games of the last 15 or so years, including Fallout New Vegas, which is probably my favorite entry in the Fallout series, as well as South Park, The Stick of Truth. So there is a South Park RPG that is really quite well regarded, made by these guys, because these guys are possibly the best writers of serial branched narrative in the business. And what they've done with The Outer Worlds in particular, it's, I think, actually kind of speaks to a lot of the themes of this particular episode of this podcast, because The Outer Worlds is a really bitingly funny and charming satire of the corporate world. It is set in a solar system that has been colonized exclusively by corporations and by big corporations. They're all run by the board, which of course has a chairman, and all the super rich people who are sort of at the very top of the corporations live in, you know, a sort of a very fancy place called Halcyon, and then there are all of these kind of outer colonies that are struggling to get by, and you sort of go throughout these planets and do, you know, video game stuff. You like go here and you pick up this thing for that guy and you kill these radiated aliens. And but also what you spend a lot of time doing are talking to all of the people that exist in this world. And what you find as you move through the game is that everywhere you go, there are factions that are trying to make their own way and trying to exercise a little bit of freedom from a world that has, from a universe or a solar system that has been dominated by a corporate structure that is so powerful that it is effectively a government. And so this is a game about how people, when faced with extremely restrictive, kind of quasi-governmental, quasi-corporate power, what they always do is they band together into little organizations and they find ways to do their own thing. And sometimes that's religion. There are sort of two competing religions in this world, the philosophists and the scientists, one of whom believe in going with the flow and the order of things. The other one believes that all is chaos and that there's sort of no order or structure to the world. There are all these like little corporations that you meet, right? And all these like even like quasi non-corporations. Yesterday, I ran into a crew, and this was like this is again sort of an example of how like strangely funny this game is that I ran into a little tiny crew of mercenaries who were playing corporate raider. They'd been hired to guard a facility, and they just like went on at me about how the corporate form was actually the best form of organization in human history for getting things done. And that's why this like little four-person band actually has a corporate structure with a comms guy and like somebody to do the finances and like another person who's there for HR and then another person who's like, here's mission planning and resources. And it's just funny and weird, and there's a bunch of like shooting aliens and stuff too, but like you really play the game because it's so clever and like and does such a great job of not just being like big corporations are bad and terrible, but also showing the ways in which authoritarianism and control leads to people kind of pushing back and setting up and trying to live their own lives and trying to exercise choice. And then you get to be a little bit of a part of that while also making drug runs and choosing which, whether you're going to side with the religionists or the ethical corporation that wants back in to be part of the board. I sided with the ethical corporation.
Catherine, you can go next, but maybe you can just frame it as, do people with kids play video games?
They do, actually. People with kids totally play video games.
How?
I mean, not me. I don't know. Not this person. But
I can't.
Sometimes when Peter is telling about video games, I feel that I fall into the same sort of trance-like state that when people are telling you about a really weird dream they had, Matt Welsh.
Oh, yeah.
It's like the same. It's like there's not quite enough narrative structure, but like it sort of hangs together. It's sort of interesting.
Or like when your oldest dumb child tells you all about, either 13 Reasons Why or
God,
Hunger Games.
I got what I really consumed this weekend was about 43 monologues about the different sub variants of Power Rangers. So I'm really feeling you on this. The Mystic Force is better, by the way.
Guys, there are so many episodes of Power Rangers.
So many. Okay.
The way you feel about video games is the way I feel when I look at summaries.
Worst part is that in the original
decades of Power Rangers,
the original cast, who played the yellow Power Ranger? It's not. It doesn't hold up well.
Catherine.
Doesn't hold up well.
Always the whatever, man. Pink Ranger is a hate crime. Okay, so. I, this weekend, reread some chunks of The Elements of Justice by David Schmitz. He's one of my favorite philosophers out there. He combines a sort of personal David Bowie vibe with a Zen-like meditative voice, and he has a sort of genuinely fresh and interesting look at the question of what is and isn't just. I was rereading him because I am preparing for my debate on Tuesday about whether or not capitalism is a blessing. It's an Intelligence Squared debate. I will be debating alongside John Mackey in favor of the idea. And Dave Schmitz, more than almost anyone out there, has some sort of fresh and illuminating and kind of human defenses of market societies that I thought might be helpful arguments to marshal for this debate. So I will leave you with this thought from him, which is that market society is a game where you win by making sure other people are better off with you than without you. The end.
Catherine, can people see that, buy tickets to it, attend,
yes,
et cetera?
If you're in New York, I believe there are still tickets available. You can come see it in person. It will also be streamed live on Facebook, and we will be embedding that Facebook player on our Facebook page as well as on our website. So you can watch it. It is Tuesday night, and I urge you to tune in and enjoy the bloodshed.
Great. Thank you all in listener world for tuning in to the Reasoned Roundtable. And again, reminder, please go to reason.com/podcasts and subscribe to the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie. He's the handsome guy standing there in the corner. And also the Soho Forum debates as well. You'll be glad you did. And we'll see you next Monday. Goodbye.
Was not expecting this to end with enjoy the bloodshed.
That's what your whole what I'm consuming was basically enjoy the bloodshed.
Just because I've killed a lot of raptodons does not mean.
What the fuck is a raptodon?
Exactly.
Okay.